Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. This is NPR News. I'm Chris Farrell, in for Carrie Miller. My guest today is Zani Mittenbettis, the editor-in-chief of The Economist, the global weekly publication. And I also have to say, I'm a fan and a regular reader. Earlier in her career at The Economist, she was its Washington editor, economics editor, business affairs editor, and emerging markets correspondent. She'll be giving a talk at St. Mary's University of Minnesota on April 25th. The title of her talk, What's Next? Making Sense of a Global Economy. Well, welcome. I'm glad you could join us.
Thank you for having me.
So before I get to some of the longer-term outlook questions, I want to look at Donald Trump. And recently, he's been making some changes in his economic outlook. I mean, he said that he's not going to label China as a currency manipulator. And now he likes the U.S. Export-Import Bank. He appreciates NATO. Low interest rates. Hey, that's not so bad. And he's even said nice things about Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen. So this is quite a shift from the campaign promises.
It certainly is. I have to say it's a welcome shift. I hope it lasts. The one thing about President Trump is you're never quite sure where he's, what his opinion is going to be next. An interesting phrase that I heard during the campaign, it's not my phrase, but was that there are two kinds of Donald Trump. There is Dark Donald and Trump Light. And I think we're moving from Dark Donald to Trump Light. And I have to say that's terrific and long may it last.
I mean, there's been a lot of concern that with the Trump administration, this post-World War II international architecture was under assault. Is it really going to be able to withstand some of the things that he seemed to be saying? So what is your sense? Is the architecture more robust or the administration maybe less anti-international architecture than we thought?
Frankly, I think it's too early to be sure.
Okay.
We are we're very early on in this administration. And I think it was not just the election of Donald Trump, but also in the European context, the British vote to leave the European Union were two powerful, if you will, admonitions to the established order last year. And I think they have led to a lot of soul searching and a lot of questioning as to whether the multilateral liberal internationalist framework, and I use liberal there in the English sense of 19th century liberalism, whether that could was what needed to change, whether there had been a sort of populist backlash against it. And I think it is proving more resilient. I think in the case of President Trump, he is realizing that once in office, actually many of these institutions have a purpose and that global stability and multilateralism are virtues and need strengths, and that his America First approach, there was a reason and a good reason why the U.S. built up and led the multilateral system, which is that the U.S. gains from it. So I think it's early days yet, but it does seem promising that the more extreme, let's kick everything down approach that, as you say, was evident on the campaign trail, seems to be toned down.
So that leads into really the title of your talk, What's Next? Making Sense of a Global Economy. So what are you emphasizing?
Well, in the short term, I think, as you suggested, an awful lot depends on what the Trump administration does. The U.S. is the world's biggest economy. It's the global economic and indeed geostrategic leader. So a sharp shift in where the U.S. is going would have enormous repercussions. So I'm obviously going to talk a little bit about that. I think it also depends on what happens in China, the world's second biggest economy, where there is a very big and very important five-yearly gathering, as you know, in October this year, which President Xi Jinping wants stability for to cement his power. Europe is an extraordinarily interesting period right now. We have, for example, coming up in the next few weeks in France, a presidential election, which is literally a four-way race between one person from the far left, Marine Le Pen from the far right, a chap, Emmanuel Macron, who doesn't even have a party, and one sort of, if you will, traditional center-right candidate. So there's enormous uncertainty in Europe, and I'm going to talk a little bit about where I see all of those heading. And the interesting thing for me is that this political maelstrom, all of this anti-establishment backlash, the populist backlash, if you will, is occurring at the same time as the world economy is actually enjoying its first sort of synchronized acceleration since the end of the Great Recession. If you look now, you've got growth. You know, the U.S. is looking okay, and certainly if you believe the surveys, people are feeling much, much more optimistic. Europe is picking up a bit, and Asia is picking up.
Okay, this leads to all kinds of things, but sort of looking at the, I guess, the medium term, one of the things that's been striking is how world trade hasn't expanded the way that people thought it would once the global credit crunch and the Great Recession was over. So do you see that global trade itself will pick up, or are we moving to something slightly different when it comes to global trade and the sort of internet information economy world we live in?
Well, I think there are actually signs that it has been picking up a little bit recently, but I think we are in the midst of we've had at least three big economic shocks. When tomorrow's historians look back at the early 20th century, they will point, I think, to at least three big things. And the first is obviously the financial crisis of 2007 and 2008, the biggest since the Great Depression. And academics will tell you that financial crises take a long time to recover from. In fact, there's one study that says it's about 8 years. So we've been living under the shadow of that for a while, which is one reason why growth has been slow, why economies have been dampened. The second big change, if you will, is the demographic one. We are living longer. Many people are reaching the baby boomers in particular are reaching retirement. So we're in the midst of quite a big demographic change. And the third one, which I think we're nearer the beginning of than the end of, is the sort of technological revolution that started with computing in the 1980s and then moved to the internet and now big data and mobile and all the other things that we, I think, are just at the cusp of and will unfold over the next decade or two. And those three together have profoundly changed the global economy. And you could even add a fourth, which is the which is partly a function of the others, but is also one, an important one, which is the integration of China into the world economy, which altogether have been these very, very big shocks to the world economy and have meant that recessions and rebounds from recessions are quite different than they had been in the more immediate past.
So much more muted, takes a lot longer for the recovery to unfold?
Well, all three of the factors that I just mentioned, so the demographic one, the technological revolution, and the aftermath of the financial crisis, all actually point to relatively weak demand growth, relatively weak spending. Because the demographic one is as people are reaching closer to retirement, they're likely to feel the need to save more. The technological revolution has been one of the big reasons for the widening inequality that we've seen across lots of Western countries, but particularly in the United States. And that in itself dampens spending because, to put it crudely, wealthier people spend a smaller share of their income. And then the aftermath of the financial crisis also dampens spending because people are trying to reduce their debt levels and rebuild their balance sheet. So there are all reasons why we might see a slower rate of growth, a weaker economy than one might otherwise expect. And then on the other side of the ledger, there is, of course, the question of what's going on with productivity. And
right. You
know, productivity has been rather lackluster, surprisingly so. And that's probably the biggest long-term question hanging over the U.S. economy and indeed most Western economies, which is, you know, is productivity going to accelerate thanks to all of these whizzy technological innovations, or are they somehow less able to improve efficiency than we think?
So where do you come down on that? Because there's this argument going on that, look, if you look at a lot of the more recent information technologies, they've enhanced the productivity of entertainment, but they're not really enhancing the productivity of business. The way
it's
that the
internet, about Facebook,
exactly.
That's the argument you're saying.
Yes.
You know, there's a little bit to that, but I think there's several things going on. One is, and it's not clear to what degree this is the case, but I'm fairly sure there's a problem of mismeasurement to some degree. We're actually not able to capture in our traditional measures the utility, if you will, that people get out of these things. So it's not just entertainment. It's ease of, it's efficiency. It's able to live in a different way than we used to be able to live. And I think the way to gauge that is to ask yourself, would you be prepared to give up your smartphone? I assume you have a smartphone.
Yes, that's a good assumption.
Would you want to go back to a world where you don't have it?
No.
And I suspect the answer would be no. So we value what that gives us quite a lot, even though it doesn't necessarily appear in the GDP figures. The second is that every time there is a technological revolution, it appears not to be making much difference at the beginning. Famously, in the 1980s, a famous economist said, you know, you can see the computer revolution everywhere except in the productivity figures. And I think we may be having something similar now. It takes a while for businesses to be disrupted and to change the way they work in order to incorporate the technology. And we've done that now for computers, you know, in the 80s and 90s, and we've done it for the internet. But there's so much happening now with AI, artificial intelligence, you know, big data, which will fundamentally transform businesses from finance to retail to pretty much everything. And we're just at the beginning of that. So it's not surprising to me that we haven't seen the full impact on the productivity figures yet. I think there's a lot more to come.
You know, I think it was Sir John Templeman that said that the four most dangerous words in the English language are "this time is different." But, and we've gone through, what, every 20, 25 years, there's an automation scare. We're going through a really powerful one, you know, leading built on off of just what you're saying, that the artificial intelligence, the algorithms, the robots, that this is a fundamental shift. And, you know, sure, productivity is going to go up, and that's great, and we're going to be wealthier, but there aren't going to be jobs this time around. The technological employment is there.
That's the classic lump of labor fallacy,
right?
The idea that there's just a certain number of jobs to go around, and if computers do or robots do them, there won't be any for us. I'm very skeptical of that, in that, you know, as you say, that's never happened before in history. There were people who said the same thing, you know, in the Industrial Revolution, and a huge number of new jobs were created because there was a demand for a huge number of new different kinds of jobs. I'm fairly sure that will happen again. I also think that the arrival of robots and automation will, in different industries, take a different length of time. So it's not all going to happen tomorrow morning. You know, we may have automated long-distance trucks disrupting the trucking industry long before we have, you know, automated robots delivering packages to your house. I mean, who knows which
right.
comes first, but it will take some time. And then there will be new jobs created in the same way that when, you know, the smartphone was invented, there's a whole industry now of people who create games. That job didn't exist a couple of decades ago. That will happen again. But what is also true is that these new jobs will require new skills and different kinds of skills. And so there are always people who haven't got the skills that are necessary to thrive in the new economy. And I think that's the really big challenge we face, and it's the one we've, frankly, not done very well at coping. And to go back to where our conversation started, part of the anger that, you know, many people feel about the U.S. economy right now and about the world economy, and when they feel that the deck is stacked against them, it's that it's not actually so much China and trade as much as it is technology, which is the two factors together mean that jobs are changing rapidly. And if you don't have the skills to deal with that, then life is pretty tough.
Yeah, I remember back in, I think it was 2008, Kia opened a plant in Tennessee, a manufacturing plant. But they didn't hire anybody that didn't have at least some kind of community college degree. They weren't hiring high school graduates.
No, that's absolutely right. And I think one of the striking things that I find it very useful to look back at what happened in the end of the 19th century. When we were we had a similarly large technological revolution that happened relatively quickly. Think about how dramatic the social change that accompanied that was. So, for example, in the U.S., essentially the rise of universal secondary education happened, you know, began in the late 19th century, early 20th century. That was a response to the requirement, the sort of literacy and numeracy requirement that you had to work in, you know, on assembly lines and so forth. And you had, if you will, educational levels matching technological change. If you fast forward to now, and we're in this environment where presumably, if I'm right, we're going to have a very rapid pace of technological change for the coming years. And yet if you look at the education system, certainly in my country, in the UK, and I think in the United States too, it really hasn't changed very dramatically, if at all. You have, you know, pre-K or K through 12, and then, you know, you may or may not do some tertiary education. It's essentially the same system that we set up 100 years ago.
Well, that raises one of those questions. You know, it's a cliche. It's been out there for a long period of time, you know, lifelong learning. And people have always talked about it. But now it looks like the way the economy is evolving, that needs to be taken really seriously, particularly if people are moving in and out of the labor force or, you know, changing careers or changing jobs.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. In fact, we put, you may have seen it earlier this year,
yes, we did.
Lifelong learning on the cover of The Economist because I'm along with my colleagues, we think it's an incredibly important part of the response. And thinking creatively about what the role of the state is and what the role of the individual is and what the role of, you know, our employers is in building that system strikes me as one of the big challenges right now. And absolutely, we have to, I think, get used to, and certainly, you know, our children, the next generation, have to get used to a life where you, the idea that you learn all your skills, you know, in your when you're young and then you don't do anything beyond that is no longer what you need in the 21st century.
But when you look at the populist backlash that you mentioned that is going on in the U.S., it's happening in Europe, it's happening in Britain, you know, there is this sort of sense of, oh, we can't really do that much. We can do some training, we can do some retraining, but it doesn't really work. And people so seem to be really grappling with what do you do for people where they lost their job because of trade or they lost their job at technology or a combination of the two, more than likely. What it is that is going to give them optimism and hope that, okay, I lost my job, but I can do better, or at least my children can do better.
I think that's right. And I think that if we look back at why this backlash has occurred, that's the biggest shortcoming and the biggest failure, frankly, of, you know, those of us who believe in an open, integrated, globalized world didn't do enough to ensure that there was broad support for it. And I think it's not good enough to say, oh, well, there's nothing we can think of doing. That's clearly not true.
Right.
We can do much more on education. It is true that traditional training programs have tended not to be very successful, but that, you know, we just need to think harder about doing better ones. It also means thinking more creatively about the welfare state and what is the right way to provide sufficient security that people feel secure, but obviously not smother free enterprise with a huge welfare state. And interestingly, the big difference between now and, you know, the early part of the 20th century is that the state was very small then. And so essentially, you know, a large part of the response was by actually creating a bigger state, by introducing income taxes, by raising taxation levels and the government spending more. That's really not an option, at least not one I would advocate, in countries that already have a pretty big government and a pretty big state. So it's more a question of thinking how to do things differently than it is simply saying more government is the answer.
Well, one of the ideas, as you well know, but is out there in Europe, it's here in the U.S., at least among the commentariat, which is universal basic income. And Silicon Valley seems to be embracing universal basic income. What do you think of the idea?
Well, we've thought quite a lot about the universal basic income, and I'm afraid it strikes me as one of those ideas that looks less good the closer you look at it. The reason is, and you're absolutely right, it's something that people in Silicon Valley are very enamored of. And at first sight, it sounds terrific. You just give everybody the same amount of money and they have enough money to live off, and then who needs to worry about, you know, the complexities of social provision. The problem is that you, because of its universality, if you, some people want to have a universal basic income instead of all other existing programs. Other people want to have it on top of existing programs, and that's an important difference. If you have a universal basic income instead of, you know, whether it's Section 8 housing, whether it's, you know, Medicaid, whether it's all of the current programs we have for less well-off people, it's almost certain that many people will actually be worse off than they are now because it will be set at a lower level than they get. And because it's universal and it goes to everybody, however wealthy they are, the cost of it is much higher than if it was much more narrowly targeted people who really need it. And so I think, for me, I'm much more enamored still of the idea that you essentially top up people's income who don't have the skills to earn as much as we consider to be a sort of social minimum. But if you give everybody a universal basic income and you put it on top of existing social programs, you have to raise a huge amount of revenue. So you're going to have very, very high tax rates. And it's not clear to me that that's something societies either want to do or indeed should do.
The workplace is a social institution, and when people are isolated from the workplace, they're not included. They feel that they're outside of the mainstream. And so the other thing I just wonder is, you know, putting more money into education, the training, into job subsidies, attaching people to the job market and putting a focus on that as opposed to, well, you're a citizen, we'll give you a certain amount of money. And as Robert Skidelsky said in his book, you know, you'll do sculpture in your backyard.
I tend to be where you are on that, which is I think that there is an enormous amount that people gain from involvement in society. Now, the response, because I've made that argument to people, and the response I get is, well, that's just because you're so blinkered in your current work-centric view, and we could have a one where, you know, if you... And maybe it is a failure of imagination on my part, but for the moment, I absolutely agree with you that public support, which will be necessary in some form for some people, should be targeted in a way that it increases the incentive to be attached to society and to frankly do something productive in society. And so I actually find the EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit, although it could usefully be reformed, but it's basically the idea of topping up earned income is to me a more sensible one for the moment than the idea of giving everybody a universal basic income. Now, who knows? We may come to a world, you know, decades down the road where actually, you know, robots are doing so many things that there is, you know, the calculus changes. But for the moment, the universal basic income for me is not a solution to the problems we have.
So then, shifting to another one of the major forces that you mentioned, demographics, the aging of the population. It's a global phenomenon. It's happening in Europe, happening in Britain, here in the U.S., elsewhere. And most of the conventional forecasts are about how bad this is. This is going to undermine the dynamism of the economy. And yet one of the things that struck me is how this sort of 55-plus, 60-plus, 65-plus are coming back into the labor market and starting to work well into those traditional retirement years.
Yeah, of course. The longer we live, the longer we're going to have to work, broadly, because otherwise our whole retirement systems are, you know, unsustainable if we don't increase the number of years that we work, if we're going to all live to 100 or however long we're going to live. So I agree with you. I also think, though, that the challenges for me may be somewhat different than the ones that people focus on now. And people, as you say, focus primarily on, if you keep your retirement age where it is, you know, how do you fund retirement? Well, I think people will have to work longer. But there are huge inequities in aging. If you look at the U.S., you see life expectancy rising most dramatically for higher-income people.
Right.
And for lower-income people, and indeed for some parts of the population, it's actually falling. And that, to me, will be a very stark dividing line where you have, you know, longevity, long length of time in the workforce. The more educated you are, to put it very, very oversimply, you know, the more likely it is that you work longer and live longer. And that gets back actually to the conversation we were just having earlier, which is the cohort of people who don't have right now the requisite skills to thrive at, frankly, whatever age in that economy.
So what are you looking at? What are you following in terms of dealing with this rising inequality in terms of life expectancy and, you know, the type of income that people can expect later in life? I mean, here in the U.S. is basically Social Security, which is not that generous.
Well, I think it's going to demand quite a lot of rethinking on all of the elements of sort of public provision of services, of social welfare, and a rethinking of what is the right role for the individual and what is the role for government. And so in some areas, you know, I think on healthcare, for example, which is a subject of huge contention in the U.S., but actually, you know, although it was far, far, far from perfect, some of the shifts that the Affordable Care Act made strike me as being sensible ones in terms of broader provision. That's going to be a continued discussion. The discussion about how you top up or ensure that there are adequate resources going to people who who really lack the skills is another one. And then the third and most important in the long term is education, whether it's lifetime education, whether it's training, whether it's thinking more, you know, more creatively about how we do that. But I'm quite sure it's not simply, you know, raising more money and spending it. I think you have to think very creatively about what the government does in the 21st century.
So on your fourth major factor, China, I look at it sort of two different ways. Love to get your reaction. I mean, one, the China shock of the, 2004, 2005, that period really did seem to hit a lot of the Midwestern manufacturing U.S. in a negative way. But then you look, you could eliminate the ocean. And if you do sort of Silicon Valley out to China, it's one economic area that extremely dependent on each other. So how do you see the relations between China and the U.S. evolving economically?
Gosh, that's a huge
I know.
Question.
It's a big one.
To look backwards first, I think there was a China shock because there was a very big increase in the scale of Chinese exports and thus the kind of import penetration into the U.S. from China. And it happened in – it hit quite concentrated areas of manufacturing quite hard. And the evidence does seem to be – and there are now several papers written about it, although it's not clear what orders of magnitude, but there does seem to be evidence that because it was concentrated and quite fast, it had greater effects than people expected. So there was no doubt that if you – you know, when you have a country of that size – increasing its global export share as dramatically as China did in the early 21st century is, you know, huge benefit to the world overall, but it was a big dislocation. But I think that was a one-off dislocation that we sort of have behind us now. It's now integrated. So it's not as though we're going to have the same kind of shock coming again and again.
Okay.
And there are quite good reasons, I think, to think that there are no other countries that are likely well, there's certainly no other countries as big as China, but there are also not likely to be similar. There aren't many more Chinas, if you will. India is obviously a huge economy, but India is a much more domestically focused economy and is likely to remain so. Going forward, I think the U.S.-China economic relationship is and will be the world's most important economic relationship. It's actually as much a geostrategic relationship as it is a purely economic one. And I was just in Southeast Asia, actually, just after President Trump was inaugurated. And it was very telling. It was just after he had canceled the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And how many of the other signatory countries in Southeast Asia felt that, you know, this was for them a huge deal. They had signed up to an economic trade agreement, which for them was much more than just a trade agreement. It was binding these nations together with the United States across the Pacific, and suddenly that was no more. And the large economy to their north, China, is the sort of huge behemoth that they have to work out how to deal with. So I think that both because the U.S. has been through the military hegemony in the Pacific region, been very, very prominent there, and that's clearly going to be shifting over time, and similarly the economic relationship is going to shift over time. So I would say that in the next coming decades, that's absolutely the most important. And getting that, one of the reasons many people were very worried about President Trump were that some of what he was saying about China, whether it was the currency manipulator or, you know, very high tariffs on China and, you know, it had been a bad deal with China, got the alarm bells ringing that would be, that's where we would have the most dangerous of trade wars. Fortunately, that seems less likely now than it did a few weeks ago.
And one of the things that struck me is business hasn't said that much complaining about what Trump said about China, and yet you look at the amount of investment that American businesses have in China, I would have expected more of a pushback.
Well, I have been quite surprised how American business has actually since November, American businessmen have been focused on what they see as the upside of the Trump administration and have essentially discounted the idea of anything negative happening. And so pretty much everybody I've talked to says, it's great, there's going to be lots of deregulation. We had far too much regulation in the Obama administration. There'll be corporate tax reform and a tax cut and infrastructure spending, and all of that's great. And when you say, well, what about, his protectionism and the risk that there's going to be a trade war? Oh, that's almost certainly not going to happen. That's the sort of that's the reaction one often gets. And, you know, it looks increasingly as though that may have been the right reaction. And goodness, I hope it is.
Well, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. It was fun.
Zanny Mittenbaedis is the editor-in-chief of The Economist.